This is Frank Hymans interviewing Russell Fitchett for the Millers Point Oral History Project. Today is the 20th of January, 2006, and I believe it's Russell's birthday today, huh?
It is.
Congratulations, Russell. The place is Cremorne, New South Wales, where we're doing this recording, and this will be tape number MPFH41, Side A. Right, Russell, usually in these interviews we ask people, give them some details. So I know it's your birthday today, but which year was it that you were born?
1948.
Right.
In Sydney Hospital.
Right.
That's sort of the as much as I know about it. I was born in Sydney.
Do you know who brought you into the world?
I honestly don't. I just know that I was born in the Sydney Hospital. I have a sister who was born somewhere in the eastern suburbs of the hospital there, but I know I was born in Sydney Hospital. That was it.
Were your parents already living at Millers Point at that point?
They were. My mother had been working in the cigarette factories in Kensington. My father had moved from the north coast of New South Wales with his parents to Observatory Hill in Millers Point, and they met in the city after the war and whatever, and that's how I came about, I suppose.
I believe your grandparents go back a long way to Millers Point, do they?
Yeah, they originally were in the pilot. My grandfather was in the pilot service. He was a lighthouse keeper, a pilot station keeper. He was also a boatman in Port Macquarie. He was involved in a rescue up there of a boat had overturned on the bar, and he got the Royal Humane Society Award for that, for his bravery and whatever. And then as a kick upstairs, I suppose it was, they asked him would he like to come and work in Sydney. And when he came to Sydney, he had the option of a house on Goat Island, Fort Denison, Pinchgut as it's known, or the house on top of Observatory Hill next to the observatory. And that's the place that they chose because they could walk around and do things and not be reliant on a boat. And he worked for the Maritime Services Board all his working life in Sydney. They lived in that house for 39 years, I think we worked it out the other day.
Now, your grandfather was also a rent collector for the MSB, wasn't he?
He was. When I was a small child, some mornings and some afternoons, depending on what his rounds were, he'd take me round and you could see what the area had at that time. Places I still remember going into the morgue. He used to have a game of cards with the morgue attendant every morning. And the morgue attendant had always, I always remember these small bottles of milk that were on one of the morgue refrigeration systems where they kept the bodies. But there was no body on the slab. But this fella used to keep his salads and that in there to make his lunches with, and my grandfather, and he always stopped there on his rounds to have a cup of tea. That was where he had his smoko of a morning. And I always remember the morgue attendant as being a very funny man, strangely enough, and that's down near where the overseas terminal used to be. I don't know if the building's still there in actual fact.
So what memories do you have about this morgue and being there with your grandfather?
I remember that we used to go in and they'd have a game of crib, I think it was, with the pegboard and everything, and they'd have a cup of tea and they'd tell stories. But I always remember the bloke always had a bottle of milk for me. I think they were a third, the same that used to be issued at schools, about a third of a pint of milk. I don't ever remember seeing any dead people or anything there, but as I said, that was part of the morning round. And the afternoon round with my grandfather, it used to start from the back of up where the IBM building is now at the end of the Harbour Bridge, and we go around past what was then the Sydney Cooperage, was where they actually made all the wooden kegs for a lot of industries in Sydney. And I still remember seeing the young boys there whose job it was to carry a pot of burning embers to burn the inside of the kegs. They char the inside of the kegs for when rum's put in them, and that the carbon inside the kegs actually changes the chemical composition and makes the drink smoother, what's in the keg. I remember that my grandfather told me all the staves that they made the kegs with were bought out from Sweden or Scandinavia somewhere. I'd call it Scandinavia. And you watch the old fellas with the long bladed scrapers actually getting the angles right, and to watch these kegs appear as if by magic. It was, they put the base down, put the staves in, they'd wire things to tighten them up, and for a 6 or 7 year old kid, it was really very clever to look at. I know a lot of people I've talked to just in recent days don't even remember that place being there, but yet it was there. It was down below Fort Street. It's where the fire station is now at Millers Point, and that was the Sydney Cooperage there. And it was probably, I don't know if it was still there in the 60s, but it was definitely there in the 50s, the early 50s and that. But then I think that all that area got knocked down, what was there, because they wanted to make new approaches for the harbour bridge and everything.
Right. How many people used to work in that cooperage?
I'd say there could, I always remember lots of people. There was always lots of kids, which I would assume were apprentices, kids that appeared to me to be between 13 and 15, I'd say. But there was possibly a dozen or so full-grown men. Plus, there was always trucks going in and out with the barrels or the staves, the timber that was that were making the kegs out of. There was fellas whose jobs were to put the top in. That was the final job, was the top went in. There was blacksmiths there, actually there making the bands, the steel bands for the kegs. I know that the old Tooth's Brewery used to get all their kegs from there. It's now no longer a brand of beer in Sydney, but it was a famous old brand of beer a long time ago. But there always seemed to be lots of things going on, and for a six-year-old kid it was always exciting. My grandfather used to have friends there as well that he used to go. I don't know whether he actually collected the rent for that, because the whole of Millers Point was owned by the Maritime Services Board. There was the only thing freehold, I think, was the churches and a couple of their demands for the church and things like that. So I don't think there was any other freehold properties in Millers Point at the time.
And you also talked about a blacksmith in Bettington Lane, is it?
Yeah, there was. It was basically when they'd formed the rocks or whatever, and it was all carved out of sandstone. Like I've seen some of the old pictures that were not the rocks at Millers Point, where the hill used to actually, Observatory Hill used to slope right down to the harbour, but they cut all this area out, and there was a hole in the wall in Beddington Lane. It was in the sandstone, and there was an old fella who used to make two things. He used to make bag hooks for wharfies and bale hooks for wharfies. The bale hook was like, if you've seen slasher movies or whatever, the bad person's always got this big hook in his hand. Well, that was for using on wool bales, and the smaller bag hooks were for carrying, for picking up things like bag flour, bag sugar, rice, any cereals and that. The smaller bags, I remember, being about 70 to 90 pound, and the bales, of course, were massive wool bales. But this old fellow used to make he'd start off with a bar of steel, and because we were kids, we could turn the handle on his brazier to supply the air for the coals to heat, and he'd quench it in water and oil, and he'd tell you why he was doing it. But he was famous for these hooks. Every wharfie in Sydney would get their hooks from him, because they had a reputation for never breaking. He was an old style thing, but then I have been down there recently to look, and there's no trace of that. That's all gone. But it wasn't very flash. It was just this hole with a couple of pieces of corrugated iron on the front, and he's forged tools there, which no one ever touched. I mean, no one ever stole them or anything. But it was very interesting to go down there as kids and watch him doing all the stuff which you don't see today, I suppose.
Do you remember his name?
I've got no idea. I know that he was a retired wharfie himself. And he possibly made knives out of old hacksaw, power hacksaw blades, which are a really big wide thing, because most seamen used to have to carry a knife and a spike. And I don't think he made the spikes for seamen, but I'm pretty sure he did make knives as a favour to people. Like he put them on the grinder down there and everything and do what he did. It was an old whetstone thing that you get, and he put a good edge on them, and the old hacksaw blades were very good for cutting rope. It sounds silly, but I know that from personal experience.
So do all the inhabitants of Millers Point bring their knives to this man to be sharpened?
No. I do remember a fella on a bike that used to have a little setup on the back of his push bike, they come around and you sharpen your scissors or your knives. That was, I'd say, very, very early 50s. At the same time, in a Holden, FJ Holden utility, so it had to be about 53 or 54 model, the rabbit man used to come around. And he had a big wooden chopping block in the back of his ute. There was two fellas, one bloke used to drive, the other bloke was in the back. And they had literally hundreds and hundreds of pairs of rabbits. And I think they were sixpence a pair. And if you wanted the fur, it was an extra penny. But they'd butcher them in the back of the truck as they come around. They'd be, you know, calling out, "Rabbit-o, rabbit-o," and which was a good cheap feed. I can remember eating so much of it as a kid, I wouldn't dare eat it today. I can remember what it tastes like, and I haven't eaten it for 40 years. We used to eat a lot of rabbit because it was a cheap meal in all its forms, baked, stewed, whatever. But they were things that used to come around as a regular occurrence. I can remember the Iceman coming around, and the Iceman was a local fella, and I can't remember his name, but he won either £1,000, it was the major state lottery that he won, and he bought this ice run. And he went broke because refrigeration was coming in. And I remember my father saying, you know, he was lucky enough to earn £1,000, probably would have bought you 10 houses of Balmain at the time. I don't know how much a house of Balmain was. I can remember him being £300, but that was just before the decimal currency changeover, 66. That's how, like, not like it is today. But there was things like that that I remember. We used to get bulk milk deliveries. You used to leave a little tin billy can out, and the man had come round, and he had a truck with a massive spigot and a big tank in the back, and he'd fill your billy and leave that on your window sill. And then later on it went to bottled milk, of course. And I can still remember, I don't know when it was, but I can remember flavoured milk coming in cartons, and I thought, that's the cleverest thing I've ever seen. These cartons of flavoured milk, chocolate milk and the thing. But those things that, and there was an old fellow used to come around selling oysters. He'd be in the pub every certain day, and he'd come in and sell oysters. Or there'd be fishermen that come up from the harbour and sell prawns. There was an old Chinese fellow that used to sell small goods. I always remember, he's such a little man, but he had this big wicker basket, and there may have been 20, maybe 25 kilos of salamis and stuff like that. And I thought, later on, I thought, stranger, the Chinaman would be selling that, when they think it would be more like a European style of thing. But they used to come around. There was an old fella in Kent Street, directly opposite the Captain Cook Hotel. There was a very narrow lane. It was only about 8 foot wide. And as kids, we were always interested, because we'd see this bloke coming in and out all the time. And he used to dye popcorn in there, make popcorn. For sale at Easter shows and things like that. And apparently when he died, there was a lot of money found in there, because he was an old fella and he put it away to keep it away from the taxman or whatever. But that was directly opposite the Captain Cook Hotel on Kent Street. And I couldn't tell you what nationality the fella was, but he was there for years and he'd coming and going. And we always wondered, as kids, we always wondered what's in there, because it was, security was brilliant on it. Even though it was only corrugated iron and locks and padlocks, you couldn't get into it, because every kid in the Millers Point had tried, and you could see down from up on Observatory Hill down into it, but you didn't actually know what was going on in there. And just you saw him coming out with all this dyed popcorn, so as children you thought, hey, there's sweets in there, you know, we can get some of it.
There was a guy called Jackson, wasn't there? He used to sell some stuff as well.
Wally Jackson, he had his own truck, and he used to cart at the Sydney markets, which are Paddy's markets now, down in the bottom of Dixon Street, Chinatown. And of a Friday, because the distributors and that didn't want stuff laying there going rotten over the weekend, they'd either give it to Wally, or Wally'd buy it off them at a modicum of price, just to get it off the premises. But every Saturday morning, he'd be parked there, and just about everyone used to buy their green groceries from there. I can remember coming down with my grandmother, and he always had this massive big chopper for chopping pumpkins and things like that. But he made his drinking money out of it, I suppose. Pardon me. But he never charged exorbitant prices. He never, he made a little bit, and everyone still got very cheap produce, which was good for the area and that. And the especially because there was a lot of widows from after the war, and he always made sure they got stuff for free if they were going a little bit, not travelling that well. You know, they weren't, didn't have a lot of money and that. But most of the people in Millers Point, shopkeepers like that, you could, if you weren't cashed up that week, you could tick something up till the next fortnight, sort of. You just put it on the bill, and they'd hold your credit, and they'd only give you a certain amount, but it got you through the skinny part of the week, sort of thing. So, and most of the, there was a lot of little tiny shops around Millers Point. People were living in the house behind it, and just opened little shops over the years, I suppose. But I can think of one, two. There was three in Kent Street, three little shops in Kent Street. And each individual one had something that no, that the other ones never sold. So if you went there, you got something and whatever. But yeah.
Interesting. Now, the cottage that you lived in with your parents, or was it your grandparents?
My grandmother, yeah.
Yeah. It was number two cottage on Observatory Hill.
Yes,
that's. Can you describe what it looked like, in the layout, the interior?
Yeah,
and so on?
Yeah, it was. It looked out directly onto Sydney Harbour. In a direct line with Lavender Bay, which is on the opposite side. You walked up, there was a path. You walked into the house, there was one bedroom on the right-hand side, two bedrooms on the left-hand side, and a lounge room. And that was the cottage as such. Then you walked through a little, it was an added-on piece, like a covered walkway, where there was a bathroom. The toilet was out in the yard outside the house itself. It was it was always had sewage while I was there anyway, but in years before it may have been an outhouse type. And then there was another building at the back, which was actually the kitchen and where we ate and things like that. Originally, I believe it was a storage room. There was a fireplace in every room too. There was a fuel stove in the kitchen. But all the rooms inside had, and they had a Welsh slate roof, because when the National Trust actually came to renovating it, I think the cost of the roof was hundreds of thousands of dollars, because they had to renovate it with this original Welsh slate shingles. It was very expensive to do, and that was one of the reasons my grandmother, who they'd lived there for 39 years. When they finally did leave, it was because the roof was leaking and they wouldn't repair the roof until the family moved out. And I think it's a state state government office or something there now. But the yard, it had a small yard at the back, had an old copper and wash tubs out in the backyard under a covered awning. And there was a side yard which led onto the house, the adjoining house, which was where the original stone wall of Fort Phillip is. And there was a house and a residence there with an old couple called their surname is Ross, Harry and Ethel Ross, and they lived there for actually longer than my grandmother. They were there when my grandmother arrived, and then they died just prior to my grandmother moving out of the place. But and the cottage itself was originally called the Messenger's Cottage. What it was there was a set of flagstaffs on Observatory Hill, which were semaphores for shipping. And because you could look directly down the harbour to the heads, and the messenger had a bike. And what happened in the house next door, they had photos and paintings of ships for identification purposes. And they'd identify the ship coming down the harbour, which were usually sailing ships. I had seen a lot of the old photos and paintings when I was a kid, but they'd send the messenger would go to the shipping company, which was usually in Hunter Street or down that area and bottom of George Street. They'd find out what wharf that the ship had to go to. The messenger would then ride back up the hill and tell the semaphore station, who'd semaphore the ship or the tug that used to tow them around, and so the ship could know what berth to go to. And when we were up there, it was called the Messenger's Cottage, but because of the tenancy that we or my family had there, it's now listed in books as Fitchett's Cottage. It was always called Number 2 Cottage, and that's directly adjoining the observatory. There was only the three buildings there, and there was another couple of, there was another cottage, which was the Weather Bureau Cottage, at the back of Observatory Hill. That was the only other place that actually had people living. There was only the observatory, the Weather Bureau Cottage, Number 2 Cottage, and Fort Phillip, which is the big stone wall that's still there today.
So those old drawings or paintings of ships that you saw,
yeah,
to identify, were they? Were they to identify the ships coming in the harbour? Were they in the Messenger's Cottage?
Yeah, yep. No, they were in the house next door. During the war, they had put a tower for radio communications in there. And I can remember this front room having a big old, like a Marconi radio setup that was prevalent on ships. It was the old Morse code style thing when I was a kid. And it was only there, and it wasn't used. But there was piles of these paintings. Some were pencil sketches. Some were very old photographs. And they were there supplied by the shipping companies so that people could see, and usually most of them had a profile on the side, or a front on and a side view of them, so you could work out what ship it was, because every ship had individual markings or whatever. And although I don't think they could see the name, especially when they were right at the end of the harbour, but you'd be able to work out the configuration of the ship and therefore tell the messenger and he'd go and tell the bloke. But those paintings were there when I was a kid, and I'd say they'd be A, really valuable, B, very, very historical because of the record of the ships that would have come out there. But the fellow that lived in the place, the Rosses, I'm pretty sure their son managed to get rid of them.
Would that be John Ross by any chance?
No, Don Ross. He was a merchant seaman as well. And he had another brother, Maxie Ross, who was a merchant seaman as well. But he lives in Adelaide. Although I doubt very much that he'd be alive today, Donnie, because he was a lot older than I am. Yeah.
Now, we haven't spoken much about your parents. Can you tell me a bit about them?
Yeah. Dad was he went to New Guinea in the war. When he was a kid, he was a surf lifesaver in Port Macquarie. He was the Beltman, and they won an Australian title that year. I remember that. Mum, her parents were second generation Australians and worked for the railway at Junee. Her father worked on railway stations, and I don't know if her mum actually cleaned the railway stations or not. And then later she came to Sydney during the war to work because of the war effort or whatever. And she met my father then. But my father used to work for the Maritime Services Board. He was a tradesman as such, but never worked at his trade. He was a French polisher cabinet maker. Done some very good work. I saw stuff that he made for his mum, which has long since disappeared, unfortunately. But he never actually worked at his trade because he went off. As soon as he got his certificate, he went off and joined the army. He drove ambulances in New Guinea. I don't think he ever fired a gun, but whatever he saw in New Guinea, it really affected him. And he became, well, after, when I was a kid, he was okay until I was about 10 years old, and then he gradually became a chronic alcoholic. And as chronic an alcoholic as you get, lived on the streets, basically because he didn't want responsibility, didn't like responsibility. And Mum and him got divorced probably 1966, I'd say, and they were still living together at the time, but after that he went backwards really. It wasn't because of the divorce, it was because of what he wanted to do. He just didn't want responsibility, he couldn't handle it. But he was a nice man. He was, I can't ever remember him raising a hand to me mum or my sister. I can remember him yelling. He was a good yeller. But he was very good at carpentering and things, or as I said, because of his trade, I suppose. But he worked for the Maritime Services Board as a painter from the time after the war. That was his first job when he got back, was to work to the Maritime, and I assume that's through the relationship with his father working for the Maritime as a rent collector and previously in the pilot stations. And he used to paint the wharves in Sydney. That was it. And I always remember we always had paintbrushes laying around the house, which were gifts for friends that he managed to pick up, and there were excess to requirements for the Maritime Services Board. And you could always get a gallon of paint off Dad. If people want to paint a room in their house or something like that, where they'd been waiting for the Maritime Service Board to do it, and in the finish they said, oh, bugger it, we'll do it ourselves. But, and Dad could always swap. When we lived, when we'd moved from Observatory Hill to Gloucester Street, there was a Playfair's factory on the lane in the rocks there, and Dad could always swap a gallon of paint for a big string of smoked sausages, salamis, corned meat, things like that. There was always a bit of bartering that went on, and it was quite good, really.
Right. Now, you all lived with your grandmother, including your parents? Is that what happened?
Yeah. When they were married, they moved in with my grandmother. It's my mother and father. And then I was born, which was not that long after it. And then for 6 years, we lived with my grandmother at the house on Observatory Hill. And then after that, we'd moved to, I can't think of the number in Gloucester Street, but it was a five-story house with an attic and a cellar on two street levels, which was looked directly down Sydney Harbour over Circular Quay to the Heads, and its location was right in the middle of where the Carl Expressway is today, in the dead centre of that on Gloucester Street. There was an old lady who lived in an identical house next door. They were like a big tenement building. We only lived on two floors of it because it was just too big a house. And three of the balconies had been condemned by the Maritime, so you weren't allowed to go out there. They actually had them boarded off, so you couldn't go out there. But the view was absolutely spectacular. It looked in a line directly across the top of where the Opera House is now, which at the time was an old tram depot. As kids, we used to go down and fish down there. And straight down the Heads, it was a magnificent view, and it was a nice old house.
Right. Now, did you play in the observatory itself as a child at all?
I did. My grandmother was one of the cleaners, and Mum worked as one of the cleaners in there as well. The state astronomer at the time was a fellow called Harley Woods. He had a son, Chris, and I can't think of the daughter's name. Sometimes I can, and I just can't at the moment. But we used to play in the house, or I used to play in the house with the daughter, who was the same age as me, and we used to, like, I can remember all these massive volumes of books, which I assume were astronomy, and archives, that they're not there anymore. I have been in there for a look, and it's all changed. There was wall to ceiling, and the ceilings were 16-foot ceilings in the observatory. There was only one actual telescope in the observatory that was used for looking at the stars at the time. And I have actually looked at the craters on the moon with that. And there was a telescope in the sun, which used to, in the front of the observatory overlooking the harbour, that used to get the afternoon sun. And there was these, I remember all these filters that you could actually watch the explosions on the sun. And as a kid, this was wonderful. And of course, the observatory itself being the timekeeping place for New South Wales, they used to fire a 1 o'clock gun in Sydney, but because of industrialisation, the noise overcame the 1 o'clock gun, and the 1 o'clock one was the gun was so all the ships in the harbour could set their chronometers to the right time, Greenwich time, mean time, for navigation purposes. Well, when they realised that they needed something else, they mounted a ball on the top of the observatory. It was a ball that was worked by a water-driven ram, hydrostatics, I think that's the word, or hydraulics. And the ball itself was a copper thing, and it used to go up very, very slowly and sit at the top. And then right on 1 o'clock, there was a valve that you opened, and it used to drop the ball halfway down. Well, any ship that was in port could look and see that and know that was the time to set their chronometer. Actually, inside the ball, there was a small inspection door, and there was two little like wooden seats, so you could sit on either side inside the ball. But for maintenance, to grease the wire that it used to go up and down on that was connected to the ram, you could actually go for a ride up and down. And I've actually been in it once with the fellow that was doing the maintenance, and so I can say I've ridden the time ball in the observatory.
Just stop you a second, I'm going to make an announcement. That's the end of tape number MPFH41, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH41, side B. That's all very fascinating stuff, Russell. And what else was in the observatory? I believe there's some flagpoles there.
Yeah, there was. The original flagstaffs were mounted in the when I was a child, they were laying down in the yard. They'd been removed because they were excess to with the new communications and whatever, and they actually laid, and they were like ship's masts with cross pieces and everything, as you'd imagine a sailing ship's mast. They had big copper bands on them to hold the timber from splitting and that, but they were laying in what was Mrs. Ross's yard, not the observatory. But in the observatory, they used to have a full-size bowling green in there when I was a kid, like for lawn bowls. They also had, I don't know what year it was, they actually built a new building for a new telescope where that old bowling green used to be. And as kids, I had access to it because mum and my grandmother used to work there, but no other kids from the area were allowed in there because there wasn't security guards at that time, but the fences were always locked and the door, but we had an access door where we could just go, and if not, we could climb the front fence. There was a little ladder on the front fence between the two buildings, but the people that lived in there were basically, I don't remember seeing a lot of people coming and going from work there, but I when I think about it, obviously there was other people apart from the state astronomer, but he was there for, I'd say, the overseeing of everything, and he was a very nice fella, and I think his son went on to be an engineer, and I can't think of the daughter's name at the moment for the life of me, but I know the son and the daughter are alive, but both Mr. Woods and Mrs. Woods died quite a few years ago. But in the observatory, I still remember there used to be a rack of cannonballs in there. They had the English ordnance mark, which was like an arrow that you see on convicts' uniforms in the old movies and things like that. And these cannonballs were stamped, and like there was an impression in cast into the ball. But they were still there when I was a kid, and we used to roll them around, even though they were extremely heavy. And I can't ever remember there ever being a gun there for them or anything, but there's possibly still a couple of them laying around up there, but they'd be covered by feet of dirt now because of all the different things that have been changed there since I was a kid.
It's amazing, isn't it?
There was a full-length paling fence went around one side of the, in actual fact, it's a Balmain side of Fort Phillip, because Fort Phillip was like a hexagon, that's where the observatory is. And on that paling fence, there was a fellow that they used to call him the Mad Painter. And he wrote a treatise against royalty. He hated royalty. And every paling, and I mean, we're talking thousands of palings, or I'd say probably 400 metres of paling fence, 6 foot high, and it was written in just normal handwriting with pencil on this paint because it showed up really good on the whole fence. He used to come up every day, and this treatise against royalty, he just hated royalty. So, and I assume the English royalty, I don't know if it was any other royalty. I never stopped to read it. But.
Now, the Maritime Services Board, were they good landlords?
They were excellent landlords. They had their own tradesmen, which were on call any day of the week, virtually. The rents were quite adequate at the time, like for working people and whatever. But if anything at all was wrong electrically or plumbing or whatever, it was almost instantaneous. And you always used to be able to speak to the boss of the section. There was you never dealt with underlings. You went into what's now the museum, modern art museum, I think, is the maritime building. And you used to go in there and you saw the rental area of that, and you dealt with the man who was at the top of the thing. And if you happen to have relations working there or working for the Maritime, you got really, really prompt service. I know that everyone else that had places there have told me that they were always the best landlords that were ever there. I think it's the Housing Commission run it now. But it's also gone from being a working class area to be avoided to with a coat of paint becoming one of the birthplaces of our nation. Like, it's, well, they were very good, though, as I said, and they had their own, the Maritime Services Board even had their own rat squad, which was a set of fox terrier. They usually had 6 to 8, I think, dogs, and they always had a set of puppies coming on, because my father always used to work next door to them. The paint section was next door, and he'd say, "Do you want to come down and have a look at the new puppies?" And we'd go down and look at the, and these fox terriers, they'd take them onto a wharf, and they'd seal all the sheds on the wharf, and they'd just put them in there. And at the end of the day, there'd be hundreds of, because when they caught a rat, they'd kill it and bring it back to the boss to show them, and these had all, and it's something I always remember, these little foxies with these, and some of the rats were humongous. They were really giant rats.
But, so it was their ratting squad, wasn't it?
It was. They had their own rat catchers. That was part of the, I suppose, the quarantine section of the shipping and that, because all ships went demoralised. You had a rat guard that you put around to stop the rats getting off the wharf onto the ship and vice versa, because every ship had rats on them at somewhere.
You think there could be shades of the bubonic plague of, well, 1900?
Well, that's, I think, is possibly the reason that they actually had the rat group with the foxies, was because I think it was pretty much common knowledge that the bubonic plague, when it went through Sydney, which, I mean, I've only read about it, but what my parents told me was, how come, because I said, how come the Maritime Service Board and all the hotels and all the wharves and all these houses, and that was right around from virtually Balmain area, anything that was waterfront, right around to Woolloomooloo. And it was because when the bubonic plague went through there, the Sydney Council didn't want anything to do with it. Like, they said, you're the waterfront looker after us. You have this and you clean it up. You know, this is all in your bailiwick. You are responsible for it. So they inherited all these. I think my father told me that something like 150 hotels, freehold hotels and things like that, that were there, that was because everything had been condemned, had either been burned or limed or demolished to get rid of the plague, because and I'm not exactly sure of the years. I know it was very early in the 19th century, sorry, not all the 20th century, but 1900s. But
it was exactly 1900, I think.
Yeah. As I said, I'd only heard about it, and then later in my life, in my adult life, I've read a lot about it, you know.
Now, as a child, where did you used to play in Millers Point? Which areas?
We used to play, if it was football, we played either on Observatory Hill or on the village green down in front of the Garrison Church. It's where the trams used to come up past the Garrison Church. There was a terminus at Millers Point, and they go back. As children, we used to do a thing called scaling the trams, which, I mean, it was always called scaling the trams to us, and I assume scaling meant to scale as in climb, and we used to climb on the tram as it come past the Garrison Church, because there was a stop there, and ride it round to the terminus, just to annoy usually the tram driver and conductor, because there'd be 20 or 30 kids do it. And then when the tram took off to go back to the city, to go back down Lower Fort Street and back into up George Street, you could jump on it there and get off at the Garrison Church again and wait for the next tram to come round.
It's the game you used to play. Did you also play in the wool stores?
We really drove the people that worked in the wool stores mad in Christmas holidays, because it's very easy to topple bales of wool over. Very dangerous, but we didn't know that at the time. But the old wool stores, what used to be called Dalgetty's Bond Store, and that, we used to play hide-ins in there and hide from the men that were chasing you. And I remember there was up behind the Palisade Hotel in the wool stores up there, there was a wooden conveyor belt, which was, the bales would be offloaded off trucks out the front, then onto this conveyor belt, and it'd go along maybe 100 feet and it'd drop down, because the wool store was built right up above the wharves, and there was 4 or 5 levels on it. And what they used to do, if whatever bales had to go to a certain level, there was a massive set, like it looked like railway sleepers, were pushed across so the bales could drop from the top, hit these sleepers and bounce off onto the floor that they wanted to get off to. And also to get them onto the wharf down below, there was big, which they're not there anymore because all those wool stores are gone, but they were like a cast iron pipe, probably 5 feet across with two railway lines inside, and they put the bales on them, slide them directly to the wharf where then they were put onto the ship. But and we'd done some dangerous things there. We used to swim in the harbour. I still remember at what used to be called the Metal Wharf, and I found out later it was called the Metal Wharf was because of the blue metal that was bought there, and that was to do with buildings in the rocks and the wharf front itself. We used to get up onto the top of the bond store there, which was probably 35 feet above the water, run along the ridge capping on the roof, down the tin, and then jump. And you actually, because I was there on a ship years later, and I actually measured it, and it was 22 foot wide on the wharf that you had to clear from the roof before you hit the water. And we never lost a kid. We never lost a kid on that. And all the kids used to do it from the time they could climb up to the roof. It was...
That's not bad.
But it was things you could do in the city that not many other people could do in the suburbs. You know, you could go down fishing off the wharves. We used to go... the Maritime Service Board had what they used to call scow punts. They were a flat-bottom punt, which they used to put a collar around the piles on the wharf, fill them with creosote, and as the tide went up and down, the collar would move up and down, but the creosote would impregnate the pile and therefore protect it. Well, we used to get these little punts, and we had a hand spear, usually made out of a piece of dowel with two spikes on the end of it, two little harpoon spikes, and we'd go hand spearing leather jackets for meals and everything. But when we were kids, most of the kids had what they called our pensioners. You had someone that when you got to feed a fish, you always made sure that they got to feed a fish. It may have been an old couple that were just doing it a bit tough or whatever, single men or single women that would like to feed a fish, and it was always very easy in the harbour, especially in Christmas time when there was lots of tailor around. You could catch those on the line. But leather jackets, you could always spear 100 leather jackets in the morning, and that was a lot of fish. And so you basically looked after people that couldn't go and do it for himself. And most kids had their own designated people that they give things to, so everyone got a good chance of a feed of fresh fish.
Did you also go to Luna Park as a kid?
We used to... At the time, the trams were still running across the Harbour Bridge, which were on the rock side of the Harbour Bridge. The electric trains were on the Millers Point side, and you'd walk down through the subway, up the stairs, up onto the Harbour Bridge, and get the tram across, usually without paying. You'd usually hang on the back of it or whatever, and you'd go across, and the guards or the conductor might, every now and again, they might stop the tram and say, get off, because it's dangerous. But if not, you could walk across there in 20 minutes. We used to go across and swim at what was called the Olympic Pool. I think it still is called North Sydney Olympic Pool. But then on weekends at Luna Park, when it opened at lunchtime, usually I think about 12 or 1 o'clock, you made sure you'd had your swim in the morning and you were waiting there, because the first 200 kids used to get a bag of lollies, and usually I think it was about 5 or 10 tickets, which enabled you to have rides on the things for free. We also knew there was, if you got inside, there was a little side exit. You could get out and come back and get a second lot, sometimes a third lot, depending on how many kids were, you know, or how many kids were waiting and that. But when you did that, the amount of tickets you got, you always kept two tickets for Coney Island, which was the absolute end of Luna Park, because for two tickets you could get in there, and there was a lot of free stuff in there, giant slippery dips, a big rotating plywood disc that centrifugal force span you off, and there was lots of things you could do in there for free, and that was a cheap afternoon now, because I think that it cost you threepence to get into the swimming pool at the time, and I don't know what a pie might have been, sixpence at the time, I'm not too sure, but you could always get extra fun out of the afternoon. And then when you were finished, if you were lucky, you knew someone that worked on the little ferry that was there, and you could get the ferry back to Circular Quay and then just walk up from Circular Quay to Millers Point.
Now, I believe, Russell, that you used to borrow the little boats that, the sort of motorised tow wagons that we used. Tell me about that story.
They used to be called tow motors. They were a small tractor device for towing, before the the systems that we've got today on the wharves for moving cargo around. They were little cast iron wheeled trailers, not unlike the railway used to use for shifting ports around, or you'd see at an airport now. You see the same little trucks towing their baggage around, the same thing, but on the wharves they had these, they had a Holden motor, if I remember rightly, and they only had a handbrake. They had forward, reverse and a handbrake. I can't remember having a foot brake. But as kids, every kid before he was 8 years old on Millers Point used to know how to drive one of them, because we used to at times drive them, not to do damage with them, because they were governed to a certain speed. So they couldn't do any damage if they bumped into anything. But we did drive them off the end of wharves into the harbour, and we did drive them in between 10 and 11 Walsh Bay. There was a 4 foot drop off the wharf. You could go off 10 Walsh Bay and it was 4 foot drop to 11. And if you were really game, you could jump off just before it went off the edge. And I don't know how much damage that we did over the years to whoever the stevedoring company was that owned them. But I also knew there was one fella, he'd done it once when I was there, and he'd done it on other times. But if you drove a forklift with the actual tines, and it's very hard to break a forklift's tines, but if you drove it off this 4 foot ledge, the tines had hit the ground and the full weight of the forklift was on the tines, and they'd ring like a bell when they broke. There'd be a sound that I reckon they could hear at Town Hall Station, this metallic bong, but by the same token, if that was ever done, you never went back to the wharves for a month after that, because they'd be looking for you and you get your bum kicked down.
You were little rascals, weren't you?
We were larrikins, but we never two things we never did, and I can never remember any of the people that I grew up with. We never vandalised telephones, because telephones, not many people had them in the home, and we never stole cars. We took forklifts and things, but we never took them out of the area. But to own a car was a big thing, because those big old style Packards, Dodgers, Humber Terraplanes, Arts and Terraplanes, if one family decided to go to the beach and there was a mother and say a father and three kids, you could get at least another five or eight kids in the back seat of the car and just could all go to the beach. And we always remember that was a very special thing, that if someone had, had the car, they could take other people's kids to the beach in it. So we never ever vandalised, and we never vandalised the phones for the same reason, if someone had to call a doctor or an emergency. And I can never ever remember in my childhood the phones ever being vandalised at Millers Point. It was three outside the actual post office there, and one in a little alcove in the post office, which has since been bricked up apparently. But as I said, we were buggers of kids in some ways, but other ways we were very responsible.
Were those phones red phone boxes, the old ones?
No, the original red phone boxes were there for a long time, of the yellow thing. They were very good for putting firecrackers in, because you can guarantee you blow at least one piece of glass out of what used to be called the penny bungers. But as I said, that was the older kids that always did that. It wasn't kids that were between the age of say 8 and 12. It was the kids that were up between the age of 17 and 20 that had put the firecrackers in there, because at the time, they were the only kids that had the money to buy firecrackers. And they were also, they knew the workings of explosions. They knew if you put an explosion in a closed space, things are going to blow out. But I've seen the bigger kids do it, but the kids that were my age, we never did that. We used to play with the crackers, take them down the wharf and throw them in, trying to make fish explosions, which was, you couldn't do it, but it was fun. But we never done any of the dangerous stuff. It was all good, clean fun.
And who maintained those phone boxes?
There was a lady, a friend of mine that I went to see, was called Ronnie Roberts. His mum and his dad was a local identity. He had an early onset of Parkinson's disease and he shook, and he was always known as Shivery. His mum, who was a lovely lady and as far as I know is still alive, was a very good friend of my grandmother's. She was the cleaner of the phone boxes, so you wouldn't get kids urinating in the phone boxes or anything like that, because they knew Ronnie's mum had to clean it. And as I said before, they were a lifeline for people that didn't have phones in their home. And as I said, in the early 1950s, there was very few phones in homes around there. even though everyone relied on that phone box on the corner, or the phone boxes on the corner. And as I said, it was just something that we never did, because basically we didn't want to hurt our friend's mum or make work for her.
Right. Mm. Now, I believe that you used to see movies on the Saturday afternoon, was it?
Yeah, you could always go down in the city, because there were so many movie theatres as well. But on a Sunday afternoon, the Missions to Seamen, which was in George Street North, and that's the Church of England Missions to Seamen, as opposed to the Stella Maris, which was the Catholic Missions to Seamen, which were on Kent Street, just past Celtic's house at the moment. It's not there, it's been moved. But we used to go down. There was a minister who was he was almost a James Robertson Justice lookalike. His name was the Reverend Craven Sands. I can remember his name, and he was a very brusque fella. But of a Sunday, if there wasn't too many seamen in the place watching the movie, and they always had a movie on Sunday evening, we could come down and we'd say, you know, like, we're always very polite, Mr. Craven Sands, can we come in and watch the movie? And he'd say, well, sorry tonight, boys, we're full up. But most of the time, very rarely that was the case. You could always go in there, and at some stage they'd always serve a cup of tea and bickies. That was for the seamen, but if you were there, you could have a cup of tea and bickies with them as well. And he was very good at that, as long as you never played up or skylarked and everything. And you, of course, you had to sit through the small prayer at the start. There was always a small prayer. That was the cost of you seeing the movies, that you had to get the religion. So.
So what sports did you play at Millers Point?
Basically, most kids played cricket. The cricket was usually played down on what was termed the village green. Football, which was just pick-up sides, it wasn't anything really organised as such. But we used to play at a place called the King George Playground, which was up on the rocks right on the side of the Harbour Bridge. We used to play a lot of basketball and paddle ball up there, which was hitting the ball up against the side of the bridge. They had a woodworking shop up there, and you could make your own bats. And if it wasn't that, it was billy carts. We always had billy carts. There was always kids with skin off their knees and whatever from crashing billy carts. But basically, and of course you fished, you swam in the harbour, which usually at the time, because of the pollution that was in the harbour, you came home with an oily scale on your body and usually tar on your, or creosote on your pants and shirt and everything, and your mothers would always know exactly where you've been. You've been in the harbour again, you know, you're not supposed to go in there. But we never lost any kids in the harbour. And some, as I said, another, if you call it a sport, was sneaking on board ships. You go on board for a look and get the ship's crew to chase us out. You know, that was all. If it's sport, I don't know, if it kept us fit, we ran around a lot.
Now, you mentioned already earlier that people wouldn't vandalise telephone boxes because it was communal.
Yeah.
So was there a kind of a code of ethics in the community?
There was. First and foremost was that you never ever stole from a working person. You could steal from the boss or steal from a big company, but it was just totally out of order to steal from a working person. The homes very rarely, the front doors were closed on. The windows were always open. And I don't know of anyone of the kids that I played with. As I said, we'd steal from companies and things like that. And later in life, there were some very famous criminals coming out of the place. But the thing was that you didn't rob working people. They were sacrosanct. There was just no way, because everyone was in the same boat. And everyone knew everyone. That was the thing. The esprit de corps, I suppose. Everyone, and if anyone at all was in trouble, everyone in the village would help those people. There'd be very, very few people that weren't not interrelated, but through social things or work things, that weren't bonded together in a very, very tight-knit community. It's not like a ghetto or such, or an ethnic community, but because there was tons of nationalities and that, and everyone blended in. There was never any I can never ever remember racialism, like or racist remarks or anything like that. There was two Aboriginal families, the Taylors and Charlie Taylor's mum. And she was a lovely lady, and her husband. They lived in Kent Street, and Taylors lived in Trinity Avenue. And they were the only Aboriginals that were in Millers Point, but very good friends still to this day are the Taylors. We had so much in common. His dad was a painter. My dad was a painter. His mum was Joan. My mum was Joan. We were both named Russell. So, but the area itself was just a very compassionate area. There was always people. If someone had heard that someone was just having a bad time or things like that, you knew that someone would be around there to help them, And it was very good.
Russell, what was Christmas like at the Point?
Christmas was always, I remember it as no one would ever be turned away from anywhere. On Argyle Street, opposite the village green, I can always remember that about every third or fourth door, those that were travelling a little bit better financially than others, there was these little 5-gallon pump-up kegs. They were actually an air pressure beer delivery system. But they'd leave them on the footpath with a wet bag or some ice over them, some glasses. There'd be the old, like a meat safe thing with sliced cold meat and some Christmas cake. For anyone that was walking past that didn't have the wherewithal to have a decent Christmas, there was a cold beer there for them. And this is anyone that all walked past. And the mother of the house had come out and check that there was still cold meat there and a bit of bread to make a sandwich out of water, because there were some down and out people on Millers Point, transient homeless people. There was an old fellow called Porky Ryan who had tried to enlist for the war, but he couldn't because of a medical thing, and he later became an alcoholic, a homeless person. But by the same token, when the men went away during the war, Porky was working on the wharves, and Porky could get meat, eggs, butter, jam, things like that for people, like wives that had lost a husband during the war. He always made sure that people never went without. If he could. And then later, when his life became a bit more downtrodden and whatever, through whatever medical or his own alcoholism, whatever. But people always made sure that Porky, in the wintertime, had warm clothes. They'd walk past and go to the shop and buy a couple of pies for him or something, so he wouldn't go without a feed. And that was the sort of people they were there. He's the one that sticks in my mind, because when we walk past, he always used to say the same thing to you. Say, g'day, sonna. And he had this real gravelly voice. And it's any of the people of my age that always say, what did Porky say? If you said to them, what did Porky say to you? And he'd say, g'day, sonna. That was it. But he was a lovely old bloke. And as I said, he'd been down and out for a long time. And I know he passed away. He passed away a long time ago. But the people at Christmas time, there was always something. There was always, you had the wharfies picnic, the painters and dockers picnic, the Maritime Services Board picnic throughout the years. And at Christmas time, yeah, they always had their own little function and that. And you could always go with the other family. And there might not be a present there for you, but you still got to drink the soft drinks, eat the ice cream and eat the lollies and that. And the people themselves at Millers Point always used to seem to make sure that everyone got a little bit of something. There was always that camaraderie in the place.
That's the end of tape number MPFH 41, side B.